Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Ksubas Daf Pei Vov. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara Marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage and then go to option 2. If you're already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief 4-minute introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf Gemara before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. We begin today's shiur 6 lines from the top of Daf Pei Vav. Before we continue with the Gemara itself, we glance at the side where we have a nosei, a topic heading, which reads, Hamoicher Shtar Choiv L'Chavero, someone who had a debt to collect. We'll call that the bill of debt, and he sells that bill of debt to his friend. The friend then will have the ability to collect that debt. He will have paid less than the face value of the debt to the original lender, and in exchange he gets this ability to collect the full amount. V'chozar u'mochaloi. And the original lender, after transferring through a sale to someone else the right to collect, the original lender forgives the loan. Mochul. It's effective. The loan, the borrower does not have to pay back the money. Now, in the meantime, you'll ask, but didn't someone pay for that, right? Is he to lose out? So the halacha we just said was focusing on the lova. The lova's obligation to pay back the loan is removed. What about the purchaser? Is he not losing out? So as we go on in the Gemara, we're going to run into this as a subtopic, which we've noted on the side as a tatnosei. Haim ha-moichel chayav lufatzoi ses halokeach. Does the original lender who now forgave the loan, does he have to compensate the one who purchased from him? So now the Gemara. Gufa, Omar Shmuel. Gufa indicates a quote from that which we had seen before, and here it's brought in a more elaborate fashion, and it's the topic that we are focusing on this time. So Shmuel said, "Hamoicher shtar chov l'chavero v'chozer u'mochaloi." Someone sold a shtar chov, a bill of collection, to his friend, and then he was moichel it. He forgave the loan, mochul. That forgiveness takes hold. Vafilu yoresh mochel. Even an heir has that ability. The heir of the lender. Omar Rav Huna braid Rav Yoshua. Vi pikeachu. If the one who purchased the bill of collection is pikech, is smart, he's on the ball. He's aware of what could happen to him. Mekarkish le zuzi. Literally, he'll jingle some money in offering money to the borrower, the kosav lay shtora bishmei, and the borrower. Now, this is of course before the loan was forgiven. I would say obviously, before the loan was forgiven, so you have a borrower that knows he owes money. So what the purchaser is going to say? You know, you owe money to Mr. A. So instead of that, I bought the rights to collect, so write a shtar to me, write a new bill of debt, and here I'm even paying you for that, so that it's no loss to you. You have to pay the loan anyway. So write the shtar in my name, as presenting it or creating an image that I am the one that loaned you the money. Therefore, if in the event the original lender forgives the loan, that has nothing to do now with the lokech. Well, lokech still can collect. Let us glance at the Rashi. The upper part of the narrow lines, the fourth narrow line, Mekarkish Lezuzi, La Loive, Vesocharo Bohen, he hires him, the purchaser of the bill of collection, the bill of debt, hires the Love, Lichtov Lo Shtar Chov Bishmo, to write a contract or a document indicating a loan has been taken, with the lokeach as the lender, with the purchaser as the lender, kodim shiasu knunya bein shneihem, before the borrower and the original lender come up with some kind of scheme between them. The Gemara continues. Omar Amemar. Now here we're going to focus on the situation where that wasn't done, but rather like we said originally, the original lender forgives the loan after he sold it to the lokeach. Amemar says, Man de doin dina de garmi. This expression, doyen, is to judge, dina de garmi, cases of causative damage. There is, in tort law, a concept of direct damage, where, let's say, Mr. A punches Mr. B in the face. That's an example of direct damage. And then you can have situations where you didn't do something in a direct fashion, but as a result of what you did, someone lost. Rashi says, "Man didoin dina degarmi hamechayev es hagorim hefsed lechavero." That school of thinking, and what we're saying is really a point of controversy. But that school of thinking, it happens to be Rebbe Meir, that even when you're in a causative situation, and within the realm of causative damage, there's an additional category called grumma. We're not going to get into those differences. The Rishonim elaborate on that in Maseches Bava Kama. For our purposes, though, we're using this distinction between direct damage and causative. Here, the seller of the bill of debt didn't directly tear up money belonging to the purchaser. He did an act called an indirect type act. He forgave the loan to the borrower, and as a result of that, the purchaser of the bill of collection will now no longer be able to collect. So, do we hold someone responsible, financially responsible, to make reparations for that kind of causative loss? So the one Rebbe Meir who says yes, in this case then, Magvi Bey Demei Shtora Ma'alya. The Rashi says, Magvi Bey Bahai Shtora Min Hamochalo. Using this document, this bill of collection that was purchased, he enables the purchaser to collect the full amount of the shtar, the entire debt that's written in the shtar from the original lender. The Gemara continues, Man delo doyin dino de garmi, the school of thought that says, no, only direct damage is punishable by payment, but indirect damage, garmi, is not penalized by having to pay. Magvi bay deme naira bi'alma. Literally, it means that actually, Rashi says, don't look at the literal translation, but across from Rashi's Magvi Bei Demei Naira Ba'amo, Klomar Omer Shiloi Mochar Lo Elo Haniyor Varehu Biyadoch. The seller, the original lender, can say to the Lokeach, I sold you a piece of paper, and there you've still got the piece of paper in your hands. The piece of paper was, we'll call it, representative value. It was an instrument through which to collect actual money. But it itself is, as we said, it's only representative value. And therefore, I don't owe you anything. The Gemara continues, Have uvda, there was a case of a moichel shtar choiv lechavero that came to Rav Ashi's attention. So Rav Ashi had to, let's say, judge the case. And the kafye rafram liRav Ashi. That literally means kafi is to force. Rafram forced Rav Ashi, but we don't take it to mean that, but rather Rafram brought proofs that full compensation must be made. the Agvi Bay Kitsura Litsami. And as a result of that, the purchaser was enabled to receive full compensation of the loan that had been forgiven, the loan that he had purchased. This expression, V'akvi bay, means to enable someone to collect something. Kikshua litzami, this is an analogy here, like a beam that's used for carving images on. When you want to carve on a piece of wood images, it has to be a high quality, straight and smooth piece of wood. So the analogy is that he deserved full compensation without any loss whatsoever, and just like we pay all attention to the details of that beam, we pay all attention to the details of this compensation. It often happens when someone is giving a shiur, once delivering a Torah lecture, especially from a text like our Gemara marking shiur, and in the course of the shiur, an idea arises that's worthy of attention. And this just happened now. I noticed that the Rashi earlier, Demei Shtarim Ali, in the upper part of the narrow lines, when we were dealing with providing reparations or compensation for the purchaser, Rashi said there that we enable him to collect kol hachoyv shebesoichel. That would translate as the entire debt that's written into the shtar. If it was a debt for $100 to be collected, so now the lokech will get the $100 from the original lender who had forgiven the loan to the borrower. So there, Rashi said the kol hachov shebesoichel. We pointed out, if we didn't say it today, then certainly in our last discussion when we're dealing with this, when someone buys a bill of collection and the face value, let's say, is $100, there isn't too much logic in saying that the purchaser would pay the full $100. After all, he's now going to have to, what? Why would he pay $100 to someone just to get back $100? It would make sense that a person would pay less than the face value. So let's say he'd pay $80, which would then enable him to collect the debt of $100. So he has a $20 profit. That sounds like a good deal. The Rashi here on Kikshur Litzalmi says, Kloma Givui Gomur Kola Hefsid, that the purchaser is entitled to collect the entire loss that he suffered. That would imply not the entire loan that was written into the original document, but the entire amount that he paid to the original lender for the right to collect the shtar. So I'm just leaving that with you listeners, to come up with maybe a resolution, if our question is a question to begin with. But nevertheless, notice the difference in language between Rashi above, where he says kol hachov shebesocho, the entire debt that's written into the document, and here, under the same circumstances, Rashi says kol hahefsid, the entire loss to the individual. Let's now go back to the Gemara. Omar Ameimar Mishmei Durav Chamo Haiman Diiko Olei Ksubas Isho Ubal Chov. A person who has two kinds of debts. He has a debt to pay a ksuba, and he has a debt to pay someone who lent him money. The Islay Arov Islay Zuzi, and the individual has a piece of land, and he has cash. That's the background. Let us take a look at the side. We have a Noseic topic heading. Mishit Sorech Lishalim Ksubas Isha and Lebal Chov. He has to pay a wife that he divorced, and he has to pay a Bal Chov, someone from whom he borrowed money. V'yesh lo ksof and bekarkin, he has cash and land. Mi mekabel esma. First issue, who gets what? Let's assume for argument's sake that these are worth the exact amounts that he owes to each one respectively. So who gets what? let's say he has a $200 debt to the woman, and he has a $200 loan that he has to pay back. He has a piece of land worth $200, and he has $200 in cash. Who gets what? And Mahadin im yeshlo rak kidei tashlum leechod mehem mi mekabo. What would be the case if he has enough to compensate only one of them? Who gets the compensation? So now we continue in the Gemara. The islay arav islay zizi. He has land and he has cash. Lebalchov misalkinon le bezuzi. The Balchov, he pays off. Literally, misalkino means he removes him. It means he removes the debt by paying him cash. Le'isha misalkino lo ba'ara. And as far as the woman is concerned, he pays, he transfers ownership of the land to her. Hai ki dinei v'hai ki dinei. Each one in accordance with what they deserve. Meaning, the lender lent him cash. So he gets paid back cash. The woman, when she got married, she was reliant upon the husband's land, real estate. She wasn't relying on portables that he may have had for her ultimate compensation, but rather relying on land. So she was relying on land. She gets back, she gets the land. The Gemara continues, V'i lo iko elo chad aro, v'lo chazi elo lechad. Let us say he has just one parcel of land and it's enough to compensate only one of those two debts. Lebal chov yavinon le, li'isha lo yavinon le lo. If the lender is to be compensated, and we won't give it to the woman. Why is it so important? What's the urgency of compensating the lender? So that people will continue to be motivated to loan out money. If people see that I loan money and someone else gets paid back, someone other than the lender, they'll say it's too risky a business to lend out money, and there's a concept, shelo tinol delos bifnei lovin. We don't want the door of loans to be locked in front of people that want to borrow. So it's to the world of commerce and the world of needy people that the lenders get paid back, so that they'll always make their funds available to others. The woman, that level of urgency is not there. My time, oh, why not? Isn't there a consideration that if the woman doesn't get compensation, that will deter her from wanting to get married? So we say, don't worry so much about that. Yoyser mimasho ish roitzel lisa, more than a man wants to marry a woman, isha roitzel linose, a woman wants to be married. Omar lei rav popo le rav chamo. In learning Gemara, when you see the expression omar lei, it at times can mean a question. So that rav popo here is posing a question, a question of clarification to Rav Chama. That's why you see a long question marking. What he wants to know is the following something that you really said. Vadai de Amrisu Mishmei de Rava. Did you say in the name of Rava the following? Haiman Demaski Be Zuzi Vis Le Ara. A man from whom money was being collected. In other words, someone who owed money. And he has a piece of land. And the lender comes to claim his debt. The Omar lay, and the borrower says, Zil shkoil me'ara. Go collect your debt from the land. Amrinon lay, we tell the borrower, Zil zovin at v'aisi hav lei. You go sell the land. In other words, the trouble involved in selling a piece of land is upon you. You sell the land and bring cash to the one that loaned you the money. So did you say that? Asks Rav Papa to Rav Chama. Did you say that in the name of Rava? Omar lei lo. No, I didn't say that. Well then, Amoli Gufa Duvda Hechi Havi. So then, tell me what happened? What created? What gave me the impression that you said that? Before we go on, then what would appear is the law that if someone owes money and he doesn't have any cash, the the borrower can say to the lender here, take this piece of land and accept that as compensation. So then why was it said in the name of Rava, why was it ever said in the name of Rava that we impose the trouble of selling the land on the borrower? So Rav Chama answers, you want to know what happened? Why that had been said? There was a fellow that owed money, and the creditor came to collect his debt, and the borrower had cash, and the creditor came to collect his debt, and the borrower said that cash, that's not my money, that belongs to some idol worshipper, it's not mine. That's called Tulim Oisov. He ascribed his money, the money that he had, is belonging to someone else. So let's read that phrase again. Omar Lay, so Rav Chama said, Tulim Oisov Ba'ivik Kechavim Havi. He was that. Havi means he was that. He was someone who said that his money belonged to the goy. Who also Shalom Kohogen? He did something wrong. It wasn't, didn't belong to the goy. It was his own cash. He just wanted to fend off the Baal Chov from collecting the cash. So he did something shaloko, something wrong. Lefikach asu bo shaloko again. Therefore, we said, that's not your cash. So the land that you have, you go sell the land and give the Baal Chov the cash. But as we indicated before, if there was no foul play, then it would have been sufficient for the borrower simply to transfer ownership of the land to the Baal Chov, to the lender. Omale Rav Kahana l'Rav Popo. L'didcho di Amris, according to you, that says Prias Baal Chov Mitzvah, that there is a fulfillment of a positive command in paying debts. Omar, imagine a guy says, and this isn't too hard to imagine, unfortunately, Lo nicholi David mitzvah. He says, I don't want to do the mitzvah. In other words, I don't want to pay back the debt. But the focus here is on the mitzvah element. He says, I don't want to do the mitzvah of paying back the debt. Mine. How do we deal with a person like that? So Rav Papa answers, Omarle, Tanina, as far as your question is concerned, we have a Tanaic source that answers it. The Tanaic source deals with sinners, people who do not fulfill mitzvahs, and oftentimes you find references throughout the Shas of a person violating a mitzvah gets malchus. That's because, as a rule of thumb, negative commands in the Torah that are violated are punishable by lashing. For example, the Torah prohibits the consumption of unkosher meat. So someone deliberately, after receiving a warning not to do so, goes ahead and eats a ham sandwich. So that is culpable of receiving lashes. They're referred to as 40 lashes. Technically speaking, it's 39 lashes, but it's referred to as Malkus Arboyim. So the source says, Bamedvam Amurim, when is it said that the 40 lashes are administered? And 40 means that's the 39 lashes is the top number that you could give for one offense. When is that the case? B'mitzvus lo yisaseh, when it comes to the violation of a negative command, where the Torah says not to do something, and you were warned not to do it, and you go ahead and deliberately do it within seconds of hearing the warning. Avol, b'mitzvus aseh, when it comes to positive mitzvahs, positive commands, where they're stated in the proactive fashion, kigon shomrim lo, aseh sukkah, make a sukkah, v'yeno osin, he doesn't make the sukkah. I would say that when we say aseh sukkah, it doesn't literally mean the building of the sukkah per se, but it means aseh sukkah, make the sukkah and dwell in it. The mitzvah of sukkah is to dwell in the sukkah. And he doesn't do that lulav v'eino osei. He's told to perform take the mitzvah, take the lulav on Sukkot, and he doesn't do it. What do we do with recalcitrant individuals? Makin oisoi ad sheteitzei nafsho. We beat him up till the point of his soul's departure. In other words, the idea of a limited number of lashings does not apply. So here, if someone has a mitzvah to pay back the loan, he doesn't want to, so now you know how to deal with him. We're continuing at the top of Amud Beis. We just read the first sentence there. In the middle of the line, Bo mine Romi bar chamo me Rav Chisda. Romi asks a question of Rav Chisda. Then, before we read the question, let's glance at the side under the Nosei, a topic heading. Chefetz hamunach b'tzidei rishus harabim. Ha'im nechshav konui lebailim. When we want to, let's say, transact something, and the item that needs to be transacted is not lying in a public thoroughfare, but off to the side of the public thoroughfare. Tzidei Rishus Ram, tzidei from word tzad, the next to or on the side of. So again, it's Rashi here describes, you find variances in Rashi's explanation throughout the Shas, but it's essentially the same idea. Rashi here says, Tzirshus Rabim, the first narrow line, Somuch l'ksolim shein derech b'nei odom lavor shom l'schachich b'koslim. Right next to the walls of buildings that line a public thoroughfare, people don't walk right up to buildings and thereby scraping themselves on the walls. So we can't deem it as a public thoroughfare, but it's right next to, it's adjacent to the public thoroughfare. So is an item that's lying there capable of being, of its ownership being transferred? We're working with the assumption that items that lie in a public thoroughfare, mamish, literally in a public thoroughfare, cannot be transacted. So now we saw that Romi Bar Chama presents a question to Rav Chisda. What's the question? Second line from the top of Amud Beis. Hareze gitech velo tizgarshi bo ela lacha shloshim yom. Man is divorcing his wife. He gives a divorce document to her, and he says this is to go into effect 30 days from now. She goes on her merry way and places it in that location called Sidei Rishus Rabbim, and it's there, it remains there till 30 days. It's there till after 30 days. Is she divorced? In other words, is that divorce document considered in her domain? You can see we have a diamond now. On the side, it represents Shnei Lishonos. You'll see two versions of this particular discussion. So, Omar Le, Rav Chisda says, Eino Migureshes Midarav Ushmuel. She is not considered divorced based on the teaching of Rav and Shmuel. In other words, it's the divorce document, in order for it to be effective, it has to be considered in her domain. This is outside of her domain. The Rav Shmuel Dami Trevayu, they both say, in a different context, but they both say, V'hu shetzvurim umunochim b'rishus harabim. V'tzidei rishus harabim k'rishus harabim domo. The Mishnah that we have learned, our Mishnah, spoke about items that were piled up, and it taught in our Mishnah that first come, first serve. As Rashi says on the second line from the top, Gabi Masnisin Dekotoni HaKoidim Zocha. Alma Rishus Rabim Lokoni Le Labailim Midi. Something that's in a public thoroughfare does not enable the owner to get them. Elim Kane Magbio, unless he picks them up. Hilkoch li'achar shloshim lav birshusahu de lehevei gerushin chayli. Therefore, after 30 days, this get was in the Tzidei Rishus Harabim, which the Gemara just said is like the Rishus Harabim, and therefore the divorce does not take hold, because the divorce document needs to be in her domain at the point of the divorce. So, after making this, let's say, assumption, as Rav and Shmuel seem to say, that as the Gemara says in their name, we'll say that the Tzidei Rishus HaRabim are considered like the Rishus HaRabim. The Gemara challenges this, though, with a long question. Adarabba, Megureshes Midu Rav Nachman. I would say that she is divorced based on Rav Nachman's teaching. The Omer Rav Nachman, Omer Rabba Baravua, Ha'imer L'Chavero, someone who tells his friend, Mishok Porozu, V'lo Tia K'nuyoloch Ad Lachar Shloshim Yom, draw this cow, which I'm selling to you, draw it unto yourself, but the actual transfer will take place 30 days from now. So you'll do the act of acquisition without the legal transfer taking place until 30 days. Kona, the deal works. V'afilo oimedes ba'agam. Even if the cow is standing out in an agam is a marsh, an open field. My love, hainu agam v'hainu tzidei rishus harabim. Should we not assume that on a legal basis, an agam and the tzidei rishus harabim are one in the same? So we see that transfer of a possession does take place when the item in question is in the tzidei rishus harabim. And in our case, the item in question is the divorce document. It's considered, just like there in the transfer of the cow, the agam is considered the domain of the purchaser. So to the divorce document in the tzidei rishus harabim would be considered in the domain of the woman being divorced. Lo, the Gemara says that equation is not necessarily so. Agam luchud, but tzidei rishus harabim luchud. The agam, a marsh, is a more private type area. There's no one even nearby. So that can be considered the purchaser's domain. Tzidei rishus harabim, not so. That's, we'll say, more public. And therefore, it's not sufficiently privately oriented to be considered the woman's domain. Ikar diamri, omar le migureshes midu Rav Nachman. Now, let's not forget, the question, this is a second version of the original issue. The question had been presented about concerning the get lying after the 30 days in the Tzidei Rishus HaRabim. So according to this version, Rav Chisda is answering the opposite of what we saw before. Rav Chisda is answering she is divorced based on Rav Nachman's case involving the cow and its transfer, the delayed transfer while the cow is standing in the agam. The Tzidei Rishus HaRabim ke agam domi. And the sides off the public thoroughfare are like the agam. And just like in the case of the agam, the cow standing out in the marsh, the transfer is effective. So too, the get lying in the Tzidei Rishus HaRabim will be an effective divorce document. Adarava, to the contrary, eino megureshes midarav uShmuel. I would argue that she's not divorced based on Rav and Shmuel. My love, Hainu Rishus HaRabim, V'hainu Tzidei Rishus HaRabim. Rav and Shmuel spoke about the lack of possession when in a public thoroughfare, and we will assume that the public thoroughfare and the Tzidei Rishus HaRabim are one and the same, and therefore it wouldn't be considered a place of acquisition. Lo, that assumption we're not going to accept. Rishus HaRabim L'chud, V'tzidei Rishus HaRabim L'chud. The public drag, the public thoroughfare, that is what Rav and Shmuel spoke about it. Only there is no transferal of items. It's not considered a personal domain. But Tzidei Rishus HaRabim is something different. And there, things can be acquired. So as you can see, the two versions basically use all the same terminology, but what is compared to what, and what the final ruling in each one is, you can see that is different. And now we come upon a new Mishnah, and the new Mishnah, the theme of this sugya, which starts with this Mishnah, and you'll see in the next Mishnah as well, the theme continues. It has to do with the realm of oaths, oaths that a husband can impose upon his wife. You know, make her swear regarding different elements. That's a very, we'll say, general topic heading. Hamoishev es ishto chenvonis, o shemino apetroipio. A man tells his wife to, and it is maybe an arcane expression now, but to man the store. Of course, you would say that that's inherently contradictory here. She's a woman, to woman the store. It means that the husband has items and he wants her to take care of the sales of those items by being in charge of the sales while in a store. So he appoints her to be the chenvoni. Or mino apotropa, that means he appoints her to be the executor of the house funds, to make purchases, sell things, hire workers, to deal with all financial aspects of running the house. So he appoints her as the apotropa. Hareze mashbia calls manchirze. The husband can impose an oath on his wife whenever he wants that she is not pocketing any of the monies. Rabbi Lezer Omer afilu al pilcha val isasa. Here we're just going to translate. There is, things have to be clarified, but nevertheless, he says even on her pilcha has to do with her spinning of the wool and isasa and regarding the dough. So what Rabbi Lezer seems to be saying is that a man can impose on his wife a shvuah concerning any financial concerns of his, regardless of whether she was officially appointed to be the chenvonis or to be the apotropos. Let us point out that from this point, from this Mishnah, till Pei Chesom Beis, we're going to be dealing with the general topic of oaths, of imposing shavuos. And ultimately, it's within the realm of financial matters, payments that need to be made, how much was paid, how much was not paid, and oaths that go along with that. As far as our immediate topic, we're going to be dealing with, as we saw in the Mishnah, oaths that a husband can impose on his wife. As we continue in the Gemara, we'll notice some triangles. And on the side, under our Nosei Mivneh heading, the triangles represent Nisyonos, attempts, Lifshoit HaSheela, to resolve the question. What question? Ha de Rebbe Elazar Soiver, Shebal Yochel Hashpia Es Ishto Al Pilcha Visasa, the oaths that a husband can impose on his wife regarding the wool spinning and regarding the dough household expenditures. Heim ze al yedei gilgul shvuah o lechatchila. Are these shvuas that are imposed lechatchila, which means imposed initially? In other words, the husband, for whatever reason, he feels that he can't account for monies, and he turns to his wife out of the blue and says, "You know, would you swear to me that you haven't put aside or pocketed any of our household expenditures or funds?" Or Gilgul Shvua, that's a situation where the woman had been obligated to take an oath for some other reason. The Tanakhama, for example, he told us about the woman who was appointed an apotropos, so she has to swear that as a formal apotropos, the executor over the all of the household funds, she can be made to swear. And once she swears about that, By the way, I want you to swear also regarding the daily expenses, the Pilchan Isa, that you should swear that you didn't pocket any of that either. In other words, Gilgal means literally to roll along. That once there's another formal shvuah that she has to take, we can attach this along with that. But as a type of oath to impose upon her initially that she didn't keep for herself any of the wool and the dough, that he can't do out of the blue. So that's the issue we have to deal with. Ibai Elaho, Rabbi Eliezer, who appeared in the Mishnah regarding the oath of Pilchan Isasa, Al Yedei Gilgul Ka'omar, Oy Lechatchila Ka'omar. And here, though we explained it orally, let's see it in the words of Rashi. Rashi at the beginning of the Gemara commentary in the upper part of the narrow lines, Al Yedei Gilgul Ka'omar, Deshamei L'Tanakamo, he had heard, Rabbi Eliezer had heard the Tanakama, the Omar that said, Mashbi Ala Apotropsis, Veloy al pilcha visasa vafilu al yedei gilgul shvuas apotropsis. Rabbi Eliezer was a reaction to the Tanakama, so it could be that he heard the Tanakama saying that you can impose a shvuah over apotropsis, but not on pilcha and isa at all, even through gilgul shvuah. The kevah of the shvuas apotropsis drabonan, since the oath that's imposed on her as an apotropsis is a rabbinic based oath. It's not a Torah level oath. There are differences, and they are there is an entire tractate, Masechet Shvuos, that deals with these topics. So we'll see the important points regarding the distinction between the Doraisa and the Rabbanan as we go along in the Gemara and the Rashi. So shvuas apotropsis is the rabbanan. The halo koton le tovea tainas bori. When the husband is imposing the shvuah, making a claim, he's not making a claim. I know that you pocketed these monies, and if you're denying thusly, then swear to that effect. That's a tainas bori, a claim made with certainty. That's not the case here. So once that's not the case, you're dealing with a shvuah that does not have a doraisa status. Elo, rather, what is he saying here? Ritzoni shetishovali, I want you to swear to me. That's all. I want you to swear because I have my doubts. I'm not sure. So I want you to swear to quiet my feelings. Lo megalgalinon al yada shvuachriti. When your basic shvua, like the shvuas apotropsis, is derabbanan, it doesn't have the strength to have another shvua attached to it. The shvua of Pilcha and Isa. V'asa Rabbi Eliezer lemeimar hecha dehoshiva chenvonis. When a husband appoints his wife as a chedvonis or an apotropsis, migu de mishtaba apotropsis, since she's taking the shvua of apotropsis anyway, mishtaba nami al yedei gilgul al pilcha visasa de megalgalin bidarabonon. So here you see the point of machloikis according to this approach between the first opinion and the Mishnah. Rabbi Eliezer is, does a shvua de rabbonon enable Gilgal Shvuah to take place, to be extended from it? That's one side of the analysis. Rashi continues, O lechatchilo komar, dafilu lo mino apotropa, mashbio al pilcha sharei apotropsis he. Even without a formal appointment as an apotropos, a husband, according to Rabbi Eliezer, can impose a shvuah on his wife, because she's effectively an apotropos. She's effectively, because of her role as the housemaker, she's constantly purchasing and maybe selling items for the daily maintenance of the house. And hence, Rabbi Eliezer is saying that the shvua, pilcha visa, is not something that arises only in a gilgul shvua situation, but even as a self-contained and isolated oath. So now let's try to resolve that. We continue in the Gemara. Toshma. Omru lo le Rebbe Eliezer. The Chachomim, upon hearing Rebbe Eliezer's idea of making her swear regarding Pilcha v'Isa, they said to him, Ein Adam dor im nochash b'kfifa. Literally translated, a person cannot be expected to live in the same basket along with a venomous snake. A woman, according to Rabbi Eliezer, is subject to having to swear, and we've mentioned this in the past. I'm sure everyone understands this intuitively, that swearing is a very unpleasant thing to do. And to have an oath imposed on you is something that could be a harrowing experience. So their reaction to Rebbe Eliezer is, how can you expect a woman to continue living like that if you can make her swear on Pilcha v'Isa? If you say that Rebbe Eliezer's his own opinion was that a husband can out of the blue impose initially a shvua of Pilcha v'Isa without the Gilgal institution, then shot. But then I understand why they reacted, why the Chachamim reacted so emotionally, so harshly to Rebbe Eliezer's point of view. To have that the woman is always under the threat of having an oath imposed on her. Eloi Amrzai de Gilgal. But if you say that the Pilcha v'Isa oath is only through Gilgal, my nafka lo mina. Why then should it be such a problem? Why should it be of any concern to the woman? After all, she's chayeves anyway. There's a unanimous agreement that when a woman receives a formal appointment as an apotropsis, that she is thereby subjecting herself to a shvur. So why should it matter if he can make her swear about Pilcha v'Isa as well as an attachment to the apotropsis shvur? The answer is, even then, the woman can claim, I can't live with a man like this. The Omrole, she says to him, Kevon de Kadaikis Basroi Kule Hai, since you're so picayune with regard to my daily behavior, Rashi adds to here, that's adds to this, Encha Oyhevu Maminoisi Velo Motsino de Idur Bahadoch. You don't love me. And it seems that this lack of love is manifest from through the lack of trust. I think that there are some very profound ideas in this, Rashi. That the idea of trust and love from the woman's perspective are one in the same. And since you don't trust me, and that you're questioning even such minor, minuscule activities as my preparing dough and spinning the wool, well, I can't. Lo matzina de edu b'hadoch. I can't live with you. It's like living with a snake. So from this discussion, you don't see conclusively if the Pilcha v'Isa oath of Rebbe Eliezer is something that is can be imposed in isolation or only as a result of Gilgal Shvua. I think it's self-evident that the Shvua of Apotropsis or Chenvonis, that does not create the feeling of enmity, being that it's only as a result of a formal appointment that the woman is subject to that. I think we can assume that being put into the position of a chenvonis or an apotropsis is not something that's imposed by force. It's something she would have agreed to. And once you agree to that, you understand you're subjecting yourself to financial scrutiny. But when this scrutiny reaches this extremely fine resolution of Pilcha v'Isa, even if it's through Gilgal, that's already too much. Ta Shma, Harei Shelo Potar Es Ishto Min HaNeder Min HaShvua. A man, let us say, he did not write the which we'll see in the next Mishnah. He didn't write over to her an exemption from vows and oaths. So a man who did not exempt her from Nedarim and Shavuos, that's read that again. Hare shelo potar es ishto min haneder min hashvua, v'shiva chenvones o shemino apetroipa, and he appointed her as a storekeeper, as his storekeeper, or as the executor of his properties. Hareze mashbi'o calls man shiutze. He can impose the shvuas that we've referred to whenever he wants. Lo hoshiva chenvonis v'lomino apotropia. If he didn't formally appoint her as a chenvonis or as an apotropsis, eino yochol lashbi'o. Then he has no grounds on which to impose an oath on her. Rebbe Lezer Omer, afalpi shelo hoshiva chenvonis v'lomino apotropia. Even if he had not appointed her as one of those, hare ze mashbia kolzman shi yirtze. He can nevertheless, as her husband, impose on her the need to swear whenever he wants. She ein lo chayisha shelo nasis apetripo sho achas b'chay bailo al pilcha v'al isasa. There isn't a moment in a married life that the woman isn't a type of apotropsis, the executor of funds, de facto over the daily affairs, like the spinning of wool and the preparation of baked goods, which involves, as we said before, it involves the sale and purchase of items of on a daily basis. Omru lo, they said to Rebbe Lezer, if that's what a husband can impose on a wife, namely a shvua in isolation of pilcha v'isa whenever he wants, they said to him, "Ein adam dorim nochesh b'kfifa." How can a person live with a snake in the same basket? How can you expect a woman to live like that? Shmamin, also from this presentation of Rebbe Eliezer, you can see lechatchila shmamina, that it's an oath that can be imposed even detached from the shvua of chenvonis and apotropsis. After all, he's saying here, even if she wasn't appointed formally, is that the husband can nevertheless impose a shvua regarding pilcha v'isa. And now we have the Mishnah that we just alluded to, and on the side we have a topic heading, Hapoter Ishto Mishvua, one who exempts his wife from vows. And it's all within this context. Now, there's quite a bit of marking you see in the Mishnah. You see underlining and numberings. The underlinings highlight the text that will be presented, that the husband writes to his wife concerning exemptions. And we want to know how far do these exemptions as expressed in each different form, how far do they go? What do they include and who is included? So the Mishnah. Kosav law. Man writes to his wife. Neder ushvua ein li olayich. Imposition of vows and oaths I do not have upon you. I relinquish that. The Gemara itself will ask which kind of shvua when is he exempting her from? So we'll see that in the Gemara itself. But in the meantime, we're learning about a general idea of shvua exemptions. So if he says this, that this language that we just underlined, ein yochol lashbia, avol mashbia hu es yorsheha ves haboyim birshusa. So his wife he cannot ask to swear, but he can impose an oath on her heirs. In other words, if a man divorced the wife and she died, and her heirs are coming to claim from the husband the ksuba that he owed their mother or their benefactor, so they will, according to what we're seeing here, they will have to swear these, what's called, Rashi makes reference to the Shvuas HaYorshim, meaning that they will have to swear that we were not told at the time of our mother's or our benefactor's death that she had received anything prior to this. And we didn't find amongst her documents any indication that her shtar ksuba, that her ksuba had been paid. So, though the woman herself is exempted from oaths that he would impose on her, the heirs can be still made to swear, as we just explained. The Esaboyim Bershusa, those are people that may have purchased from her the Ksuba rights. We discussed earlier people who buy bills of debt. There are people that buy the ksuba from a woman. A woman might be in need of immediate funds. Her ksuba is worth, let's say, $200. They'll pay $150 for the rights to her ksuba. That doesn't guarantee them, but only if she, the woman herself, was in the position to collect the ksuba, so they will take over her position. And they would have paid, let's say, a fraction of the ksuba and then be able to collect the full ksuba. Those are the boyim birshusa. And they too, when they come to the husband claiming, we bought her ksuba, they will have to swear that the ksuba has not been paid up whatsoever, and hence we're coming to elect. So that's a shvur that's imposed on Boim Birshusa. Another case, another expression. Neder shvur ein li olayach, v'al yorshayach, v'al haboim birshusech. I relinquish the shvuas that would have been upon you, upon your heirs, and upon those that are coming as a result of you. So what happens? Eino yochol lashvia. He cannot impose an oath. Lo he velo yorshea velo esaboyim birshusa. So he cannot impose an oath on the wife, nor on her heirs, nor on the boyim birshusa. Avol yorshav, this man's, this husband's yorshim, this husband's heirs, Mashmian oisav es yorshav es aboyim birshusa. If the man himself, that the husband had died, and he left heirs, and they are being sought out for collection, that, you know, with the claim, your father owed our mother, or if she's still alive, owed me, or if she's dead, her yorshim, or those that may have bought the ksuba, they can be made to swear if they are dealing with the yorshim of the heirs of the individual that had issued an exemption. Basically, what are we saying? The exemption is applicable only to the one himself who issued the exemption. But that exemption will have no restriction imposed. It will not impose any restrictions on his heirs. A third case. Neder ushvua ein li velo liorshai velo laboim birshusi olayech val yorshayech val haboim birshusech. So you see a much more elaborate expression. What is covered by this? So eino yochol lashpia lohu, who cannot impose oaths, not himself, velo yorshav velo haboim birshuso, not himself, not his heirs, nor those that are coming through him. Lo osa, velo yorsheha, velo haboyim birshusa. And all of those people are exempted from the shvua. The woman herself, her heirs, and those that are boyim birshusa. We didn't explain a technical point that when the husband exempts from a shvua, that I won't be able to, nor my yorshim, nor the boyim birshusi. That's a case where a man had sold his properties to purchasers, and they, the purchasers, are being sought out for as a source of collection by the woman who had a ksuba that predated the sale of those properties. So this exemption is saying then that they will not be able to impose the previous mentioned shvua on the woman or her heirs. We continue in the Mishnah. Holcha mikever baila lebeis ovia, o shechozer lebeis chamia. A woman that had received a shivua exemption. She, in a situation where the husband died, so she walks, when she walks from the burial to her own father's house, when she goes back home to where she once lived, or she goes to the Beis Chami, her father-in-law's house, that means to where her husband, where she lived with her husband. Falonas is apotropa, and she is not made into an apotropus. Ein hayorshim mashbiyan osa. The heirs have no right to impose a shvua on her. Vimnas is apotropa, if she is appointed as an apotropus. Again, we're dealing with a woman that had previously received an exemption. Now the husband is dead, and she is appointed at this point, she's appointed, let's say, initially for the first time as an apotropsis. So, v'inasis apotropsa, ha'yorshin mashbino sal osid lavo, v'ein mashbino so amasha ovar. Rashi says, al osid lavo, esek shel achar misa, on any dealings that she has after the husband's death, shelo ikva biyoda klum. That she hasn't withheld anything. At this point in time, the property belongs to the heirs. And the exemption that the deceased husband had issued was an exemption only concerning properties that were his. Once he dies, it's like the clock starts all over again. So the exemption that he had issued is now has expired. So she can be made to swear regarding any transactions she conducts from this point onwards, but not al ha'ovar. Ve'ein mashmino so al mashovar means those things, those transactions that she may have overseen when the husband was alive, she cannot be made to swear. She has that exemption still is effective regarding that. Before we continue in the Gemara, we note on the side the Nosei Mivne heading. Roman numerals appear, 1 and 2. They represent Shnei Lishoinois B'Rav Yehuda Marav. Two versions regarding Rav Yehuda Marav, who will appear in the Gemara, Ahechokoi. What is Rav Yehuda's comment going on? Ume'ezes Shvo Habal Poteroisa. And we'll also be interested in knowing from what vow is he exempting her? From what oath is he exempting her? The Gemara. Shvua mai avidita. Let's look at Rashi immediately. Shvua mai avidita. Eze shvua stam. Which general shvua? Stam means something that's not identified. A general concept of shvua. Which shvua she'isha chayeves lebayla o liyorshav, that ordinarily a woman would be obligated to swear to her husband or to his heirs. Dekatani dechilo potra mashbia v'chipotra ein mashbia. That which kind of shvua is the subject of our Mishnah that says that if she receives a formal exemption, so he doesn't impose the oath on her, and when she is not exempted, she needs to swear. What shvua are we talking about? Omar Rav Yehuda Marav. We continue at the top of Pei Zayin Omen Aleph. Al apetropia shenasis b'chaye baila. Regarding apotropsis activity that she does during the lifetime of her husband. This, of course, is familiar to us from the previous Mishnah. Now, we must add that according to Rav Yehuda, according to this version, we're in Roman numeral number 1, and that needs to be emphasized. Later, you can see there's a Roman numeral number 2, But at this point, what Rav Yehuda is saying, that the exemption covers apotropsis activity, but it does not exempt the case of what's called pogemes ksubasa. It's an important expression that we'll be seeing regularly. Now, let's look at Rashi at the top. Al apotropia, potra b'ksivazos, mishvus apotropsis, im yoshivena chenvonis. If he points her, the wife, as the storekeeper, as the one in charge of formal sales and purchases in the context of a store, that exemption covers the apotropsis type activity. Aval im pogma ksubasa, if you're dealing with a pogemes ksubasa, which we didn't explain what that was, then that kind of woman cannot collect the balance of her ksuba unless she takes an oath. That situation of her needing to take an oath in a pogemes ksuba situation, lo niftara me'oseh shvuah yedei tnai zeh, that she's not exempted with this exemption. Techipota lo, when he does exempt her, mishvua de karomi hu Allah. The exemption regards those kinds of shvuas that otherwise the husband places on her, that the husband initiates. Avol shvua de hi gormo l'nafsha lo pota lo, but a shvua that she brought on herself, this exemption doesn't cover that. So now, just a word about pogemes ksubasa. A woman comes to, with a claim to her husband, I want you to pay me the ksuba. Husband says back to her, what do you mean? I paid you the entire ksuba. And she says to him, you paid me, but just a fraction of it. My ksuba is $200, and yes, you paid me $50. I still want $150 of payment. That is called pogemes ksubasa. Now, in that case, her claim isn't based on the mere, let's say, document that she's holding, because when she comes with a ksuba claim based on the document says $200 in it. She's putting a claim in of $150. So because of that, she will need to swear to verify her claim, her, we'll call, partial ksuba amount. So, according to Rav Yehuda, once again, we emphasize, according to our current version of the Gemara, the exemption covers apotropsis, but it does not cover the case of pogemes ksubasa. Rav Nachman, we continue in the Gemara, Rav Nachman Amar Rabba Bar Avua, al hapogemes ksubasa. The exemption covers even pogemes ksubasa, and certainly the shvuas apotropsis. The idea being that this exemption is far-reaching. Not only does it cover shvuas that he would impose on her, but even shvuas that she brings on herself, she is exempted. Also, now, so according to this version, you see, it's quite apparent that there's a machlokis between Rav Yehuda and Rav Nachman. According to Rav Yehuda, no, the exemption does not cover pogemes ksubasa, and according to Rav Nachman, the exemption covers even pogemes ksubasa. According to the second version of the Gemara, Roman numeral number 2, Rav Yehuda will not be presented as one who is arguing with Rav Nachman. Of course, we'll have to wait to see what that is a reference to. We continue now on the Gemara. Ozal Rav Mordechi Omra L'Shmaitza Kamei D'Ravashi. Rav Mordechi went and he said the following. The Shmaitza is the upcoming attack, the upcoming question that is raised. So Rav Mordechai presents the upcoming question presents it to Rav Ashi. What's the question? And notice we have a long question marking. Bishlamo Lamanda Omar. I understand according to number 2, maybe Rav Nachman, al ha-poigemes ksubasa, that there's an exemption that covers even pogemes ksubasa, demasko adaita, it can occur to a woman, dilmo matzuchi li zuzi v'shakilna miksubasai. I might be in a position where I need money. People understand that in the course of life, people can be hard pressed for funds, and she'll take money on her ksuba account. The omra lay, and she'll say to her husband that upon receiving part of the ksuba money, we'll call an advance, she says to her husband, "Ksovli delo mishabisli. I want you to write a shvua exemption." Namely, in general, pogemis ksubasa needs to take an oath. And what did we say pogemis ksubasa situation is? But this is a situation where the woman acknowledges she received partial payment. Why would she have received partial payment? Because of circumstances like this. These are things that will occur to people. So in the course of requesting that advance payment, she also says, and by the way, would you kindly exempt me from having to swear later on when I want to collect the balance, when I might be in the position to collect the balance? Ela leman de Omar, but according to Rav Yehuda, al apotropos shenasis b'chaye baila, that it's an exemption for apotropos activity. When you look at things from the woman's standpoint, Does she know ahead of time, before being appointed as an apotropos, that she's going to be appointed as an apotropos? Are these things that have occurred to people? Ihi, the woman, the wife, mi havis yada de moisiv law apotropa. Did she know ahead of time that one day he would appoint her to be the executor of all of his properties? The omrole, that would motivate her to say, ksovli de lo mishvasli, write for me an exemption concerning the apotropsis activity. It's an unreasonable expectation. So that it seems to be very impractical to have a situation of an exemption covering a situation that's unanticipated. Omar Le, so Rav Ashi, upon hearing this, he says to Rav Mordechai Atun, Aho Masnisu Lo, you take Rav Yehuda's teaching and attach it or apply it to the Reisha of the Mishnah that spoke about a general Shvua exemption, not not knowing from the Mishnah what Shvua it's referring to, and you interpreted that. As you, Rav Mordechai, took Rav Yehuda's comment that spoke about Shavuos Apotropsin and referred it to the Reisha of the Mishnah. And as a result of that, you ended up having Rav Yehuda arguing with Rav Nachman. And then you come up with this question. Anan, we, says Rav Ashi, aho masninon law. We take Rav Yehuda's statement about some, Rav Yehuda made a statement concerning apotropsis, but we take his statement and attach it to the Seifa, the continuation of the Mishnah, and you'll see how Rav Yehuda was talking about one thing and Rav Nachman talking about something else. They're not arguing. What's the application of Rav Yehuda to the Seifa? So first we read the Seifa, and that's what you see in the frame. Holcha mikever by law lebeis ovi oshechozu lebeis chami ovo lo nasis apotropa. After the burial of her husband, she went back home, either to her father's house or to her husband's place, and she did not become an apotropos. She didn't do any apotropos activity. Ein hayorshim ashbiyan osa. The heirs cannot impose any shvuas on her. This is a woman that had received a shvua exemption. The imnasis apotropim, if she is now appointed, at this point she becomes appointed in apotropsis, yorshin mashbien osa al osid lovo, v'ein mashbien osa al shovar. She can be made to swear concerning any activities, any financial activities from this point onwards, and not retroactively. The Gemara says, shovar mai avidite. We look at Rashi, to explain this this phrase right across from here. Rashi says, "Sheovar mayavidite klomar ad mosai korui l'sheovar." How far back is called the past? The lo amrinon that we would not say nichsi diyasminenu v'ein tnai shelo moil bohen, that it's the property of the yisaimim and that the husband's exemption does not apply. The husband made an exemption concerning his properties, not the properties that are owned by the heirs. At a certain point it becomes the heir's property. So what? How far back does this go? When the Mishnah says that we don't make her swear concerning the Ovar, because that at that point it was still the husband's properties. Omar Rav Yudah Marav Al apetroipio shinasis b'chaye bailo chaya bal. She cannot be made to swear concerning apetropis activities, executor type activities, while her husband was alive. Avol bein miso lekvura mashbeinon lo. However, any commercial activity that she conducted between the time of death and the time of burial, that's a time that the properties are considered the heirs. So they can impose shavuos on her. V'Rav Matana Omar, afilu bein misa l'kvura lo mashbiyan la. So Rav Matana argues in Rav Yehuda and says that even sales that she might have conducted between the husband's death and the husband's burial, they cannot make her swear. And there's a reason for that. The Amri Nahardoi, in Nahardo it was said, it was ruled, Lekargo lemazoni ulekvura mazveninon belo achrizosa. Now we've dashed on like the kvura because that's the point of focus for our discussion. Sales of, let's say, heirs' properties that are made, sales that are made in order to pay off karga is a head tax. Mizoni is to provide for them their daily food needs. And lekvura means for the purpose of burying the husband. The heirs' properties can be sold, masvinyon, belach was also means without, we'll say a public auction of the properties. When you have a public auction, you are able to fetch a higher price, an anticipated higher price. But when it comes to things of this, we'll say urgency, sales can be made for whatever price that can be fetched for those sales. Rashi points out a few lines down from Masveninon, Nichse diasmin below Achrazosa, without the need for a public announcement. Achrazosa literally means a public announcement. There's a procedure that we don't have to get into the detail of, but it's a more time consuming type sale when you subject it to the public auction. But here, Shein Sheus, there's no time, Umosun Ladover, there's no time to tarry with this matter. So, just like with regard to sales, we're going to sell and not necessarily get the best price for it, but because of the urgency, v'chinami lo mashbinan alos mechira, and by the same token, we're not going to impose an oath on her for that sale. It's impossible for her to avoid cheapening it, selling it at a cheaper rate, causing a loss. And if she would have to swear that I caused no loss, it would be a lie, be an oath, a false oath. So as far as the position of Rabbi Yehuda about his comment, he made a comment, Al apotropius shaisus b'chai baila, it had no reference to the beginning of the Mishnah where there was an exemption issued by the husband concerning oaths. But rather, it had to do with the definition of Al he'ovar in the Seifa of the Mishnah. So as far as things go then, if you're going to ask, what does the exemption of the of the Mishnah cover in the beginning of it, you'd be, according to version number two of the Gemara, you're left with Rav Nachman's explanation that the Stam, the undefined Shvu exemption, covers the case of Pogemes Ksubasa, where she put herself in the situation of needing to take an oath. As far as what Rav Nachman's position is regarding Shuas Apotropsin, so if we take a look at Rashi, let's look at Rashi together. We're backtracking a bit, but it's in the upper part of the narrow lines. Rashi says, Anan Asefo de Masnisin Masninan Law. This was Rav Ashi's response to Rav Mordechai, and says that we take Rav Yehuda's point and attach it to the Seifa, the end of the Mishnah. Demairi b'shvuas apetroipen behedya. There the Mishnah, in the end of the Mishnah, deals explicitly with shvuas apetroipen dikotani. The Mishnah said, v'im nasis apetroipya. Uder Rav Nachman, as far as Rav Nachman that appeared on the top line of the Gemara, Lava plukted Rav Yehuda Itmar. He is not coming to as a response to Rav Yehuda whatsoever, because Rav Yehuda never spoke about the Reisha. Elo apirusha de Reisha Itmar. He is dealing with the explanation of the beginning of the Mishnah. Varav Matona poligad Rav Yehuda b'seifa behe apetrupsis komar l'sho'ovar. There is a machlokas the Rav Yehuda has, but that's with Rav Matona, as we saw in the Gemara on the Seifa, regarding how far back. Avol b'poigemes. Now here is the point that I wanted to get to in the Rashi. Regarding pogemes, avol b'pogemes, kulu modu d'potra. Everyone is in agreement when a woman receives an exemption, her exemption covers the pogemes situation. D'shivua habo lo al yedei nechosav hi. It's a shivua that comes as a result of the husband's property. So when the husband issued an exemption, his exemption covered the properties that were his. The collection of the ksuba is a collection from his properties. So that when the husband issues an exemption, everyone agrees that it covers the case of pogemes. Now, what's interesting to note, this is a detail, that how this second approach is contrasted with the first approach, because in the first approach we had a svara that said that the exemption according to Rav Yehuda covered apotropsis, but it wouldn't have covered pogemes ksubasa. And at that point in the Gemara, the svara was that pogemes ksubasa is a shvua that she brings on herself. At this point in the Gemara, we're saying that everyone will agree that when a husband issues an exemption, it certainly covers the case of pogemes ksubasa. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.